Poznanski, a fanatic? One man who decided he did want to know more was Arthur Poznanski, the Royal Bavarian Professor of Geodesic Engineering. He worked from 1904 to 1945 in Tiwanaku. The place fascinated him so much that, soon after he got there, he decided to remain in Bolivia, and over the years, he was lauded with one honorary academic title after the other. Poznanski was President of the Geographic Society of La Paz, President of the Archaeological Society of Bolivia, Director of the Tiwanaku Institute for Anthropology, Ethnography and Early History, Member of the New York Academy of Sciences, and so on and so on. From 1910 onward, practically nothing happened in the field of Bolivian and Peruvian archaeology unless Arthur Poznanski had given it the go-ahead. He was respected, honored, and hated. All in all, a very controversial person. Poznanski wrote 4 scientific treatises on Tiwanaku, or the Cradle of Humanity, as he called it. He despised, mocked, and scorned archaeologist Max Ulla, even calling him an illusionist, counterfeiter, and fantasist, this last in a pamphlet written to discredit Max Ulla. Poznanski was the first person to ascertain the exact geographic position of Tiwanaku, 16 degrees, 33 minutes, and 7 seconds south, and 68 degrees, 40 minutes, and 24 seconds west of Greenwich. Poznanski cursed the unprofessional destruction of the ruins by an excavator named Georges Corti, and claimed that this same indiscriminate and cavalier Georges Corti, who had carried out excavations in Tiwanaku in 1903, was nothing more than a grave robber and had caused more destruction than in any of the long ages that had passed. The indigenous peoples, according to Poznanski, had named their main temple Acapana, as their forefathers had done. In the ancient Aymara language, this meant the place where the observers dwell. That's something we really ought to keep in mind, don't you think? According to Poznanski, Tiwanaku had experienced no decadent period, and those that claim such nonsense have never really studied this prehistoric metropolis. Tiwanaku is the greatest sun temple ever to be constructed by mankind, not just in South America, but in the whole world. That was no flamboyant comparison. Poznanski was well acquainted with the structures in Egypt. In Tiwanaku, he found countless signs that pointed to a connection between heaven and earth. He deciphered depictions of stars and other heavenly bodies and noted that one of the large statues that was found in Tiwanaku carried the name Pachamama, which meant no less than Mother of the Cosmos. Paca means cosmos in Aymara. This statue bears 2 of the same winged beings on its breast that can be seen on the Sun Gate. On its back is a series of phenomenally delicate illustrations engraved millimeter for millimeter, as if the hand of the artist were guided by some kind of intricate stencil and he were using a drill of dental precision. The statue is now the pride and joy of the open-air museum in La Paz. Among the engravings, Poznanski discovered the most perfect calendar, which not only chronicled the passing of the year, but also the phases of the moon. The same applied to the engravings on the Gateway of the Sun. The priest astronomers, Poznanski, knew how to represent the winter and summer solstices, and also the equinoxes, the daily position of the moon, and even the heavenly equator, down to the finest detail. Y el eje vertical de estas dos figuras representa el Ecuador celeste. Poznanski was pulled along by his own excitement and enthusiasm. He was acquainted with all of the literature that had been written about Tiwanaku, knew the legends and lore of the Incas, could speak Aymara and Quechua fluently, and was determined to find the answer to one key question. How was all this possible? He often doubted his own discoveries, consulted with other scientists, and was still forced to come to the same conclusion, namely that Tiwanaku must be viewed a kind of prehistoric metropolis, built before the last great flood by beings that were somehow way more advanced than any kind of Stone Age man had any right to be. For Poznansky, the Gateway of the Sun was just the centerpiece of a fantastic wall filled with calendrical depictions.
La Puerta del Sol es únicamente la parte central de un formidable muro de inscripciones calendográficas.
This means that the priest astronomers must have taken the precession of the Earth into account. Precession refers to variations in the inclination of a planet's rotational axis. The Earth's precession cycle lasts around 25,800 years. Poznansky identified three construction periods at Tiwanaku and noted that parts of Pumapunku, at least, belonged to the oldest of these. This oldest period was also, paradoxically, the most technically perfect, contrary to any rules of technological evolution. As we all know, at the beginning, it's always quite primitive. Tools and techniques have to be developed. From generation to generation, small advances are made and skills improve. This only applies to a limited extent at Tiwanaku, because in one corner of the complex lies Pumapunku, built with inexplicable technology. Later generations simply tried to extend the complex with poorer quality tools. Based on his astronomical calculations, Poznansky dated the second period as being at least 10,000 years before Christ, and the oldest at around 15,450 BC. This was long before New Grange, Ireland, Stonehenge, England, or any kind of Egyptian or Sumerian culture. At least, it was if we accept established archaeological teachings. But although Arthur Poznansky was often overtaken by his own enthusiasm, he was anything but a fantasist. He was a true researcher in body and soul. He didn't simply base all his work on his own discoveries and theories, but rather called regularly on the wisdom of other astronomers, geologists, and so forth. In this way, he was able to ascertain that the fauna and flora present during the building of the first stage of Tiwanaku must have changed radically. This can be clearly shown by the remains of sea life and the silt sediments by Lake Titicaca. Poznansky searched for the quarry from which the large stone blocks came and found it around 40 miles from the site of the ruins in the volcanic slopes of Cajapfia, now known as Cerro de Escapia, near Zapita, on the Peruvian side of the border. Here, a number of various different types of andesite could be found. Andesite comes from cooled volcanic magma. Then Poznansky was confronted with another problem. How did the blocks get all the way to Tiwanaku? The most plausible solution involved specially built roads on a very solid foundation. Rollers would have then been used to get the 200-ton slabs moving. Then came the ships. Poznansky maintained there was once, without a shadow of a doubt, a canal system. The fact that there was water around can be shown geologically. Tiwanaku itself was sited on a harbor, but that was a long, long time ago in a prehistoric epoch. Poznansky was the first person to postulate a complicated and perfectly designed canalization system, including piping that, to this day, looks as if it were cast in modern concrete. In addition to this, there existed, in Pumapunku in particular, a number of underground chambers created from andesite blocks that were as perfectly fitted into each other as a waterproof Swiss watch. Poznansky often demonstrated this to his incredulous visitors by pouring bucket after bucket of water into the closed rooms. Today's tourists don't get to see these subterranean rooms. They are still there, but they have been filled in. There was one problem for which Poznansky could find no solution. Hay otra cosa curiosa. There is one other puzzling thing. At the center of the Sun Temple in Tiwanaku, in other words, in the most important part of the existing ruins, I discovered a cut block around 1 meter wide and 2 meters long. This was, without a doubt, where the priest astronomers had once placed the Gateway of the Sun in the center of their gigantic calendrical wall. The strange thing about it is the fact that this central block, lying at the holiest point in the complex, is made of a completely different kind of stone than the rest of the ruins. It is an uncommonly ugly stone. For the layperson, it looks as if it were put together from many other particles, but I suspect that this is a kind of hard trachyte with seams of another volcanic rock, making it look like a conglomerate of different stones. I would like to repeat, this stone was not used anywhere else, neither for the statues nor for the platforms. Maybe, but this can only be speculation, this was some kind of concrete casting, and, again, maybe, was where the urns lay that the constructors left for the generations of the distant future. I have looked for this uncommonly ugly block and have not been able to locate it, not in the open-air museum of La Paz, nor in the junkyard of Pumapunku. Arthur Poznanski was somewhat perplexed by his first views of Pumapunku. One is somewhat shocked by that which one sees, and it seems almost as if one were standing in front of a cyclopean workshop. En el primer momento, uno queda aturdido al ver algo que parecería taller de cíclopos. Later, Poznanski allocated the rubble yard of Pumapunku to the first and oldest period. Although he suspected that Pumapunku was some kind of moon temple, he finally conceded that the ruins will probably always remain an enigma. The translation of Pumapunku, by the way, is Gateway of the Puma. Poznanski asked the older men about their histories, and they assured him that the original name had been Winay Marca, which meant Eternal City, an ideal name for the ruins of Pumapunku. The quintessence of Poznanski's research culminates in the following. It is attestable beyond doubt that the main temple of Tiwanaku was an observatory which was aligned to the astronomical meridian, and also, at the same time, an ingeniously devised stone calendar, and the hieroglyphic and symbolic inscriptions on the sun gate are nothing less than a detailed description of the calendar's various functions. Climate change? Nothing new. Poznanski's findings were not accepted blindly, even back in those days. Like Hans Horbiger, Poznanski was convinced by the idea of glacial epochs. He had discovered an ancient building with walls that were almost 12 feet thick in a bay at Lake Titicaca. He wrote about it in the Bolivian daily El Diario from July 14, 1931. It is well known that the Earth has gone through several ice ages during which broad lakes and meltwater accumulated that once covered the entire Bolivian-Peruvian high plain. This building must have been built before the ice age, at a time when Lake Titicaca was not as big as it is now. Everyone has heard of the concept of climate change, nowadays. But back in Poznanski's day, they were already talking about climate changes, in the plural. We're not talking about examining ozone holes, we didn't have the technology back then, or taking ice cores in the Antarctic. 100 years ago, it was all about picks and shovels and good sense. The results were the same as now. Edmund Kiss, who admittedly was a follower of Horbiger and researched in Tiwanaku after Poznanski, confirmed what others after him were also forced to concede. The fact that Tiwanaku was once completely underwater is certain. The large stairway in Tiwanaku is covered in a thin layer of calcium that must have been deposited by water. It is so firmly attached that you need to take a knife to scratch off a sample. Kiss believed that Tiwanaku had been destroyed by a flood and cited bone remains as his proof. The bones of people and animals, including many species that are now extinct, lie in wild confusion in Tiwanaku's alluvial sediments. This bone sediment is at one point 3.5 meters thick. At one point, the railroad track runs through a gully with sides 3.5 meters high, and this does not even break through the bone sediment. Under the rails, the same sediment can be seen, consisting of millions upon millions of smaller and larger bones, fragments of glazed ceramic, malachite, pearls, and much more. Like Poznanski, Edmund Kiss also confirmed the existence of tide marks that ran along the cliffs for many miles. Poznanski had assumed that the highlands of Bolivia had been flooded many times because the Earth's axis had changed pushing the entire Andes region upward. Kiss, however, rejected this standpoint, but he remained convinced the Tiwanaku had been flooded at some point. The attentive observer Kiss also noted that it was not only the village church of Tiwanaku that had been built from stone stolen from the ruins of Tiwanaku, but also the great cathedral of the capital, La Paz. An Ice Age Calendar. Edmund Kiss then concentrated on the depictions on the Gateway of the Sun. He noted that, without exception, the winged forms on the frieze all had just four fingers on each hand and only three toes on each foot. After many years of study, Kiss came up with a theory that was so oddball that he felt compelled to apologize before even mentioning it. "Let me beg you now, do not just set the book down. And let me also implore you, after reading the information which I am about to impart, not to call the doctor and beg him to prescribe the poor author a course of cold water treatments. He assures you that he is indeed healthy, and it is not easy for him to proffer his broad shoulders for the inevitable crushing laughter to come." At least the man had a sense of humor. So which impossible theory are we talking about here? 1. That the Gateway of the Sun in Tiwanaku is a calendar marking 12 periods of the year. It also displays the solstices and the equinoxes. 2. Each of these 12 periods has 24 days. Only the months February and April have 25. 3. Each of these days has 30 hours. 4. Each of these hours has 22 minutes. At first glance, it does seem a little crazy, but Kiss backed up every single infinitesimal detail on the frieze of the Gateway of the Sun. Kiss calculated backward and forward. He neglected nothing, not even the tiniest detail. Everything was correct. Every tiny circle had an exact meaning. Every puma head or snake tail fit exactly into his calendar theory. Kiss showed pictures of the frieze to many of his scientific colleagues and asked them to count it for themselves and disprove his calculations. Not one of them could. It only worked, though, on the premise that a year actually did have 12 months made up of 24 days at 30 hours and every hour of 22 minutes. Did the ancient residents of Tiwanaku really use a calendar like this? And if they did, when? How many thousands of years ago? Before the last ice age? I would love to give you Edmund Kiss's variation on the calendar right here, but I would have to quote at least 30 pages from his book, and that's just not possible. Those of you who really want to know will just have to go and seek out the book for yourselves. It always helps to have a picture to give yourself an idea of what Kiss was actually talking about. Kiss himself concluded, "Can it really be a coincidence? Or is it the deluded invention of a man who, come what may, is determined to decipher the calendar on the Gateway of the Sun in Tiwanaku? Well, in that case, the number of coincidences is piling up at an alarming rate." No, the interpretation of these pictograms is not forced. It came about almost of itself as soon as the hieroglyphs on the base had been deciphered. The three references indicating where the lunar cycles are to be found, depending on the year and the month, as well as how they are to be counted, are of such a compelling logic that the way they are depicted on the calendar can be only described ingenious. Was everything that the worthy doctors Edmund Kiss and Arthur Poznanski claimed to have discovered all just bunk? Well, put it this way, they weren't the only ones. After the Second World War, a number of others followed. And let's not forget that we really should treat these two as completely separate figures, not least because of their wildly different ideologies. Hans Horbiger, propagator of the world ice theory, was known as a Nazi sympathizer and hated Jews. Arthur Poznanski, on the other hand, was no follower of Horbiger, but he did support the theory that Tiwanaku had been destroyed by flooding at the end of the last ice age. The oldest building phase in Tiwanaku, at least, is from before the last ice age. Edmund Kiss, on the other hand, was certainly a follower of Horbiger, at least inasmuch as the world ice theory was concerned. I've never read anything about him being an anti-Semite. The next man in our list of researchers actually was a Jew, Professor Hans Schindler Bellamy. In 1974, this highly educated and dear old man handed me a copy of his book with a personal dedication and begged me to make sure that researchers never turned their backs on Tiwanaku. I'm still doing that to this day. A colossal discovery. Archaeologists working under the patronage of the American Museum of Natural History in New York started excavations at Tiwanaku in 1932. Accompanying them as a kind of coordinator was Professor Arthur Poznanski. In the earth of the so-called Old Temple, the Americans found a block of stone that they initially were unable to lift out. As they dug deeper, they realized they had found a huge statue that had been worked from a single monolithic column. The diggers estimated its weight to be around 20 tons. The block was made of reddish sandstone, and it was damp and covered in a mixture of dirt and clay soil. It must have been lying in its moist bed for thousands of years. Using beams and rope pulleys, they heaved the statue out of the mire and set it initially on a wooden plinth to dry. A few weeks later, after they had gently scraped away the dirt with soft brushes, they discovered that the column was covered in fantastic messages. On its head, it wore a hat, and on both sides of its long nose, there were two rectangular eyes. The hands converging on the figure's chest were holding objects that looked like cups. Underneath were two winged beings of the same kind as on the gateway of the sun. Finally, there were indefinable scales on the thighs and feet, each of which bears five toes. The diggers stared in amazement as they saw the rear side of this mighty form. It appeared to be a message from the ancient past. There were engraved faces like those on the gateway of the sun, and to the right and left there were winged beings, crowns, scepters, snakes, condor heads, and so on. The more than 1,000 engravings are all aligned in perfect symmetry. Not a tenth of a millimeter is free on either side. The master of engraving who committed his ideas to stone all those millennia ago must have used some sort of stencil. Otherwise, this work would just not have been possible. But what was the message he or they were trying to convey? What was it all supposed to show? Arthur Poznanski deciphered the engravings as a calendar and promptly became a figure of scorn. One reason was that Poznanski's calendar stretched back more than 15,000 years into the past, which is something that could never be accepted by the Guild of Archaeology. As far as they were concerned, the oldest cultures belonged to the Egyptians and Sumerians, and certainly not some unknown South Americans. This was the same logic behind the criticism of the calendar variant on the Gateway of the Sun, as deciphered by Edmund Kiss. It was just not acceptable that any culture on the South American continent could be older than those of the Near East. If you thought that archaeo and other ologists didn't start getting in each other's hair until our times, then think again. You should read some of the polemic and ridicule being propagated in pamphlets between 1910 and 1945. Back then, as now, no trick was too low. The interpretations developed by Poznanski, Kiss, and others were subjected to academic scorn without anyone taking the time to actually check out the facts. Kiss and Poznanski, and a number of later researchers, clearly showed the existence of the tide mark of a former major body of water on the Bolivian High Plateau. It can still be seen today, but this was ignored. Poznanski and company revealed the thick layer of bone-bearing sediments through which the Lake Titicaca Railroad still runs today. That didn't interest any of the academic critics. Poznanski, and many after him, clearly demonstrated the glacial trails in Tiwanaku and the ruins that lay under them. But who cares about that? Any tourist who visits the Inca city of Cusco in Peru can marvel at such glacial chutes next to the Inca fortress of Sacsayhuaman, and they are not hundreds of thousands of years old. Otherwise, they'd be just as weathered as the other rocks all around. Without exception, all of the geologists who examined Tiwanaku between 1900 and 1950 confirmed that the area, along with some of its ruins, must have stood under water at some time. The residues show it too clearly. I can remember the Great Staircase well. It is covered in a layer of lime scale, calcium, that is so hard you need a knife to scratch it off. That didn't interest any of the critics who, and this is the greatest irony, never even visited the highlands. Back then, it was standard practice to fudge, lie, fake, and suppress anything to avoid destroying the image of beatific archaeological evolution. Geological facts are ignored by archaeology when they don't fit into the establishment's rigid view of the world. It was so back then, and it often still is today. Of course, Poznanski and company did make the odd mistake, and their interpretations of the calendar did sometimes stretch the imagination. Nevertheless, it can be clearly seen that Tiwanaku and Pumapunku could never in a million years fit in with a Stone Age culture, and it's easy enough to substantiate this claim. After Poznanski's death, Professor Hans Schindler Bellamy and Dr. Paul Allen picked up the work on the engravings on the huge statue, commonly known as the Great Idol. This was already a few years after the Second World War. And again, the conclusion was that it was a kind of calendar. Professor Schindler Bellamy even believed that the engravings on the statue were older than those on the Gateway of the Sun. He presented tables and lists. Every minute detail was calculated forward and backward. More than 1,000 engravings were taken into account, and not a single one was ignored. It didn't change anything. The illustrations on the Great Idol still constituted the most phenomenal calendar imaginable, and the astronomical dates depicted on it reached back as far as 27,000 years before the birth of Christ. Professor Schindler Bellamy knew the problems that were likely to be stirred up with any dating that stretched that far back into the past. He knew of the ancient cultures of Egypt and Sumeria. Nevertheless, the engravings on the Great Idol show immutable periods. What could be done to solve this discrepancy? Professor Schindler Bellamy argued for a rise and fall of prehistoric cultures. There must have been, he argued, other high cultures before the Egyptian culture that had foundered and disappeared for whatever reasons. Unthinkable? Not really. After all, that is exactly what Plato reported 2.5 millennia ago in his Laws. Back then, he wrote of earlier, frequent breakdowns of mankind caused by floods, from which only a fragment of the human race was able to save itself. Anyone who knows Plato's writings also knows that the concept of earlier civilizations, including, of course, Atlantis, apocalypses and new civilizations did not arise with Hans Horbiger. This kind of lore is already thousands of years old. Irrefutable evidence. Curiously enough, it is not even necessary to squabble about Tiwanaku's age, and not necessary to pick sides regarding the calendar theories, glacier melts, or cosmic catastrophes. Why not? It's because there is one extremely solid and incontestable argument, a piece of proof that is inarguable and inerasable. It is a marvel that not even the most hard-nosed critic could ignore. Geologist Alfen Stubel took precise measurements from some of the stone blocks from Pumapunku during the 1870s. These highly exact technical drawings still exist. They can be seen in Stubel and Ulla's book, Die Ruinenstätte von Tiwanaku im Hochland des Alten Peru. Block 1. It is rectangular, 9 feet long and 5.2 feet wide. The block has 6 main surfaces, top, bottom, and 4 sides. These six surfaces are subdivided into diverse smaller rectangular and quadratic planes. On the front, Alf and Stubel labeled one rectangle and two small squares with the letter P. This is where any Stone Age tool, regardless of which one you care to choose, would just lie down and give up the ghost, even if you stretch your imagination a bit and add copper or iron tools to the mix, regardless of whether it's stone axes or chisels. Just try to recreate one of those precisely chiseled forms marked with a P in a piece of diorite. It's not possible. Another, even smaller, rectangle can be found on the surface of the block, on the left edge. Right next to it is a slot or a groove. Some kind of object must have fit precisely into it. The same applies for the rear, right side of the front side. This strip must have been the seat for a counterpart, just as must have been the case with countless other recesses. On top of all this, the block is a wedge shape. The back, the upper part of the sketch, is thicker than the front. All this adds up to planning. There's simply no way around it. Stubel calculated the weight of the block to be 18,500 pounds. The material is diorite, hardness grade 8. Blocks 3 through 5. This is an unbelievable feat of engineering, as some of the blocks fit perfectly into their counterparts. Lift them up, turn them around, and stand them on their heads. All that then remains is the upper part of the next cross block, which then slots into the next piece. These are what are usually known in the construction trade as prefabricated elements. Think of them as something like Lego blocks. Every groove and every recess were accurately calculated and precisely drawn. On cocoa or maize leaves, skins, in the sand, scratches in stone maybe, or cords laid out on the ground. You can bet your bottom dollar they didn't just set off haphazardly with their chisels to create this precision work. There's just no way it would have been possible without precise architectural planning. Without tools or plans? Nowadays, work like this would be carried out using milling machines and high-speed precision drills, water or air-cooled. And these tools would be guided by stainless steel templates. Let's not forget that we're talking about hard diorite here. That means the tools that were used must have been harder than the blocks that were being worked. Let's add to this the fact that they would have needed some kind of levers and cranes to lift the pre-prepared blocks and fit them into each other without any kind of accidents or damage taking place. These blocks fit into each other like safe doors, but with a whole variety of surfaces, rectangles, squares, and levels. Modern concrete elements are utterly primitive compared with the techniques used in Pumapunku. Closing your eyes or just looking the other way doesn't cut the mustard here. Holy Atahualpa, help us! Which Stone Age geniuses do they expect us to believe in? This turns their comfortable evolution theory on its head. The gray-green diorite block, with its immaculate smooth finish and its utterly precise, perpendicularly milled groove, is enough to pull the pants down on this Stone Age fairy tale on its own, let alone the other pieces shown here. Any claim or assertion is nothing more than an unproven assumption. But as far as Pumapunku is concerned, I'm not claiming anything. I'm talking hard facts. The Aymara, the pre-Incan tribe that allegedly created this masterpiece, cannot be responsible, because the Aymara were a Stone Age people. They could never have transported these heavyweight blocks almost 40 miles. The technology used here is way beyond anything that Stone Age man is known to have had at his disposal. The overall planning and the specifics are based on geometric measurements. High-level architectural skills have been used here. The builders would have needed to have known the exact stability or brittleness, in other words, the degree of hardness, of the material. The sheer number of architectural elements would have required a writing system or something equivalent, It's simply not possible to do something like this from memory, and it would have been beyond the planning capacity of our Stone Age geniuses. These days, we plan things like this on computers. Archaeologists talk of copper or lead brackets being used to hold the platforms together with a kind of carabiner fastening. This is because copper and lead casting have actually been found in Pumapunku. Heaven only knows why anyone at any time may have used lead or copper in Pumapunku, but it certainly can't have been simply as fastenings for these heavy platforms. Lead is a very soft metal, and in its pure form, you can scratch it using just your fingernail. Its melting point is 621 degrees Fahrenheit. Its boiling point, 3,182 degrees Fahrenheit. Lead alloys would be possible, of course, but this assumes some kind of metallurgic expertise. Copper has a hardness grade of 3, iron is 4.5. None of these soft metals would have been able to hold the incredibly heavy platforms in Pumapunku together, and certainly not when exposed to the kinds of temperature variations that are seen in Bolivia. As early as 1869, Johann Jakob Tschudi wondered, "Even more than by the mere fact that they were actually able to move these blocks, we are astounded by the sheer technical brilliance of the masonry work, especially when one takes into account that the indigenous laborers possessed absolutely no iron tools and that the alloys of copper and tin they had were far too soft to work the granite." Author's note, Tschudi was wrong in one respect, of course. No granite was used in Pumapunku. It was diorite, which is equally as hard. How they accompanied this is a mystery. The most plausible view is that they achieved their final polish by rubbing the stone with a fine stone powder or some siliceous plants. My dear, long-dead compatriot Tschudi, if they had used stone powder or siliceous plants, the workers in Pumapunku would not only have had to rub for hundreds of years to polish the huge stone slabs, but also would have needed precision instruments, as the platforms all feature various planes and inclinations. The courage to be logical. Something's not quite right in Pumapunku, even if you leave aside Professor Poznanski's dating and ignore the calendars of Dr. Edmund Kiss and Professor Schindler Bellamy and others. The working of the stone is enough in itself. Today, the calendar calculations made by Poznanski, Kiss, and Schindler Bellamy have all been discounted. The well-meaning talk is of academic errors. Horbiger's world ice theory has been thrown out. Today's moon is not responsible for the destruction of Tiwanaku, and there were no earlier high cultures. Basta! It's actually true that the Tiwanaku calendar could never be fit to our own contemporary calendar. These days you would say the data are just not compatible. The industrious information collectors, Poznanski, Kiss, and Schindler Bellamy, all knew that. Their calendar had different months, days, and hours than ours. Just as an aside, the Maya calendar system, see Chapter 4, consists of a number of different calendars that mesh like cogwheels. Thus, the God calendar, also known as the Solkin, consisted of 260 days. The 260-day calendar is, however, utterly useless for the seasons of the earth. It's no good for sowing or harvesting, winter or spring, and yet it existed. So which planet was it good for? As far as the Tiwanaku calendar is concerned, there remains one key question. Why is it, then, that despite this, every single one of the more than 1,000 tiny details on the statue, the Great Idol, corresponds with one another? As far as Edmund Kiss's year is concerned, we're talking about a year of 12 months at 24 days, except February and March with 25, and days with 30 hours of 22 minutes each. Well, the question can't be answered by looking at our calendar. Kiss's calculations don't fit to our calendar, but they certainly do fit to the other one. Who knows, then, with any certainty, which calendar would have been valid before the last ice age? We deny the existence of any civilization before the last ice age. Ergo, the Tiwanaku calendar is wrong. And in the process, we blindly sweep the geological facts under the carpet. Are we not just making it too easy for ourselves? The latest variation on the Tiwanaku calendar comes from Jorge Miranda Luizaga, who at least is a Bolivian and knows both the culture and the language of his countrymen. He approaches the Tiwanaku calendar from the perspective of the Aymara, whose language he speaks fluently. The result is a practical calendar that repeats itself year for year and has its roots in the religious cultures of the Aymara. Maybe Luisaga's solution is the only correct one. I can't say with any certainty. I can judge the technology, the planning, the transport, and the architectural draftsmanship that have been used to create the blocks in Pumapunku. And that certainly doesn't fit in with the former Aymara tribe. And this brings up another question that has been completely ignored in all of the literature on Tiwanaku. Why on earth did a Stone Age culture actually need such precisely calculated and perfectly smoothed blocks like those that can still be seen in Pumapunku? For us, the term Stone Age refers generally to a people without metal tools. Stone Age is clearly a highly flexible concept, because the Stone Age is not an age in the sense that it fits in with any global calendar. Depending on geographical location, the Stone Age was 4000 BC, or among the South Sea folk, 500 AD. In Brazil's upper Amazon region, there are still Stone Age tribes living today. When a Stone Age people decide to erect a large building, they somehow manage to drag, jockey, or tow the blocks to their chosen location and pile them up on top of each other using whatever methods are on hand. To make sure the walls don't collapse, they use pins and mortises, a kind of key and lock, that need to be chiseled or hollowed out. They never use the kind of engineering arts witnessed in Pumapunku. Are you getting the picture yet? Even the carbon-14 datings of bones and wood fragments found in and around Tiwanaku are not exactly convincing. C-14 is a method of dating that is based on measurements of the levels of radioactive carbon isotope, C-14. The ruins and platforms could have been lying around for a very long time before later visitors used them to camp in or just came and pottered around. Today, it is their organic remains that are being dated. What good is that? I know plenty more examples of this kind of thing. In our times, the established wisdom is that the Tiwanaku culture existed from around 300 BC until 1100 AD. You can forget Poznanski's 15,000 years. As you can also forget all the calendar variations, the silt layers, the bone sediment, or coastal markings. There have been a number of attempts at reconstruction. But you can't really blame the archaeologists or architects if any attempt at reconstruction must remain little more than a patchwork. Too much material has been dragged off over the centuries, taken away and used to build streets and churches, broken down by the forces of nature, or simply been shot to pieces. Architects from the University of California, Berkeley, who have done sterling work in Tiwanaku and used computers for their reconstruction, were forced to admit, "The fragmentary remains are an insufficient basis from which to gain an understanding of the significance or meaning the architecture may have had for the people of Tiwanaku." Confronted with the precision work carried out by the creators of Tiwanaku, Pumapunku, all those thousands of years ago, today's commentators can only talk of fascinating compositions and incredibly tight fits, deviating from each other by no more than a millimeter. We are the prisoners of our own way of thinking and hanging constantly on the umbilical cord of evolution. For heaven's sake, please don't serve us up with anything so spectacular from ancient times. People like me, who ask questions on the basis of the platforms still around in Pumapunku today and the surveying techniques that can still be proven today, are considered eccentrics. Burn the heretics at the stake! And when that doesn't work, pour scorn on them. Hold them up to ridicule. As if I didn't actually already know all the literature in Tiwanaku and Pumapunku. Despite this, I allow myself the freedom to ask some legitimate questions. New answers. Legitimate questions? Too right! In the summer of 1966, I shot some pictures that really revealed something fascinating. They show a series of monoliths and some individual freestanding monoliths. The tops of 5 monoliths can be seen rising out of the ground. All of them display 90-degree recesses, which once would have served as anchor points for some kind of cross blocks. At the top of the huge monolith, you can see a clean 90-degree cut. Another of the photos shows, as plain as the nose on your face, an extremely fine groove from top to bottom. When you compare this with today's reconstruction of the wall, there's no sign of recesses, right angles, or even a cleanly cut groove. The interstitial spaces have simply been filled in with stones. The former recesses and the groove, which, after all, were an intrinsic part of the monolith all those millennia ago, and provide clues to whatever techniques were used, seem to have vanished into thin air. Is this just a case of retouching? It gets better. The earlier water pipes, from which intact corner pieces were found in the ground back in 1966, are now sitting at the top of the reconstructed wall. Later, a sunken inner courtyard was recreated, and heads were set into its walls that originally had nothing to do with this wall. The assiduous Bolivian and international reconstruction teams have put in a lot of effort to retrieve the former glory of Tiwanaku. Some of it has been reconstructed to death. There is still one possibility for getting a little bit closer to solving the riddle of Pumapunku. Of course, it is one that is harder to swallow than all the rest. Schliemann's route via the myths and legends. Viracocha, the god of the flowing lava sea, is said to have been one of the helpful gods in Tiwanaku. The place was built in a single night. This happened long before the time of the Incas. Carried out by unknown and powerful beings. All of this happened before the flood. Acapana, the main temple, means the place where the observers dwell, in the Aymara language. The original name of Pumapunku is said to be Winemarca, eternal city. The huge statue is called Pacamama, mother of the cosmos. On the gateway of the sun, the major god is depicted, flanked by 48 further winged figures. I know, not I believe, that our planet was visited by extraterrestrials before the flood. I've written 25 books about it, and, even if some of my evidence hasn't been so solid or even rebuttable, there are still too many things that are simply irrefutable. Anyone who has actually invested any significant amount of time examining the material will know I am right. The others should just take a moment to listen. Our forefathers lived in the Stone Age. They didn't understand anything and believed, erroneously of course, that the ETs were gods. Those of us living today know that there are no gods. Our forefathers didn't have this knowledge. These beings that were called gods back then have made their way into our myths and legends, and even the major religions. In Enoch, Plato, and others this occurred, without any doubt, before the flood. The visitors studied mankind, as today's ethnologists do, and occasionally gave out a few friendly tips to help the primitives on their way towards civilization. This can be proven. Just like mountaineers attempting to conquer mighty Everest, they needed the odd base camp here and there to store their technical equipment and protect it from the curiosity of mankind or from wild animals. So in one night, they built Pumapunku, the eternal city in the eyes of the indigenous people, the place where the observers dwell. It's precisely here that the critics jump in with the observation that extraterrestrials would never use stone. They would be able to use other materials. Excuse me! When our astronauts finally get to building on the moon and Mars, they'll use the raw materials that are on hand. They won't be dragging steel and other artificial materials to the next planet. Our extraterrestrial visitors carried out their ethnological work. Other groups may have exploited mineral resources, and a small number taught the more gifted among the indigenous folk about astronomy and other practical skills. Maybe just a little bit of development aid? To take this contemporary interpretation a little further, the core of the original temple, here, Pumapunku, was nothing more than a storehouse, base camp, for extraterrestrial technology. It may also have served as a school for a few of the more switched-on and curious locals. When they left, the ETs promised to return in the distant future. This idea became a firm component in mankind's religious thinking. Following the extraterrestrials' departure, some kind of natural catastrophe was visited upon the Earth, for whatever reason. The poor, maltreated Earth recovered, and soon groups of people gathered in mute bewilderment in front of the mighty remains of the former base camp. "Once the gods lived here," they murmured. "They built this place in a single night. No man lifted a finger in help." In wonderment, they ran their fingers along the fine grooves in the diorite, the rectangular recesses, the polished slabs. The natives took word of what they had seen to the next valley. Soon, people from all around came to admire the gods' works, the holy shrine from which the gods spied on the people. Pumapunku became a place of pilgrimage. Soon, the first temples were built to honor the gods. The people began to watch the heavens. After all, hadn't the gods said that they had come from the stars? Generations were born and died. Tiwanaku was built, one piece at a time. It's a way of looking at events that at least explains the problem of the various different architectural styles and the know-how from diverse epochs. I beg you also to consider the god variant in your observations of Pumapunku. It solves a number of problems and cannot simply be ignored just because it comes from me. After all, one thing is certain. The technology used here had nothing to do with any Stone Age race. So what do we do now? Dig. Even today. That's just what is happening, thanks to a group called Akakor Geographical Exploring. With support from Bolivia's Ministry of Culture and archaeologists from UNAR, Unidad Nacional de Arqueología, its researchers managed to discover artificially built shafts and water pipes underneath the so-called Pyramid of Tiwanaku. Monolithic slabs, highly polished and precisely worked like all the rest, make up the sidewalls and the ceiling of these subterranean passageways. In some places, the seals of the great stone slabs were no longer completely intact, and over the millennia, 15-centimeter-long stalactites had formed. In several places, the team found damage that had clearly been caused by seismic disturbances. Nobody knows what these tunnels and shafts under Tiwanaku and Pumapunku were used for. Poznanski was already writing about them in 1913. And Kiss in 1939. Yet, they were simply laughed at by the oh-so-serious scientific community of the time. So, what now? I'm still waiting for the sensible answer from those establishment dolts whose heads are eternally stuck in yesterday that the Stone Age schmucks probably needed these megalithic tunnels so that they could play marbles in the dark. There is yet another mystery that can easily be checked by anyone at any time, by laymen as well as experts. As early as 1968, I had noticed strange anomalies on my pocket compass. Sometimes the needle changed direction completely within 2 blocks. I demonstrated this strange phenomenon to several groups of passing tourists. In the meantime, my colleague Hartwig Hausdorff has made more precise measurements. In one of the stone blocks in Pumapunku, there are 5 depressions, one over the other. Hausdorff passed a compass of these holes and registered a magnetic deviation from hole to hole. It goes like this. The first hole had a deviation of 5 degrees. The second hole had a deviation of 10 degrees. The third hole had a deviation of 20 degrees. The fourth hole had a deviation of 40 degrees. And the fifth hole had a deviation of 80 degrees. He repeated the experiment several times in front of astonished witnesses. A physicist would question an anomaly like this. An archaeologist doesn't know anything about it.